This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's son. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
The title of this installment is Race and Fraud, The Races of Mankind, Part 3, continuing to examine the work of Ruth Benedict and Gene Weltfish titled The Races of Mankind, a pamphlet first published in 1943 for consumption by the U.S. military. I'll pick up right where I left off. After World War I, what section was this again? I didn't know what the title of this section was, but it comes right after the race mixing section. After World War I, it might even be part of that section. The Germans and the Czechs along the border between the two countries intermarried so often that the Germans of this section got to look like Czechs, and the Czechs began to speak German. But this did not make the two countries love each other. People of every European nation have racial brothers in other countries, often ones with which they are at war. If at any one moment you could sort into one camp all the people in the world who were most Mediterranean, no mystic sense of brotherhood would unite them. Neither camp would have language or nationality or mode of life to unite them. This is really the crux of their argument, I think the centerpiece. And it's the anti-racist argument in general. I've described it previously as this gap, this odd gap in the continuum of human relations, you know, from the very narrow human family to your tribe, to your nation, to your race, and ultimately humankind as a whole. They argue that basically race shouldn't exist in that spectrum, and you shouldn't pay any attention to that. You can pay attention to your family and their interests, and you can pay attention to the whole human race, but not race in a racial sense. And here they're arguing that people of the same race are divided. They're incompatible. Unity is hopeless because of divisions of language and religion and nationality. Well, these things divide the human race even more seriously than they divide any race, and including the white race. Their argument, which is only implicit here, but it's made explicit elsewhere in other forms of this races of man work, is that the whole human race shares some mystic sense of brotherhood and should unite. Which, if they're arguing that a subset, that it's unrealistic or impossible for a subset to do it, then their argument that a larger group can and should do it is equally false. It's more false, or undermined by their own argument. Basically, pretending race doesn't exist doesn't make those differences go away. It doesn't make everybody love each other, as they even acknowledge. The movements of peoples, I'm going to continue here, over the face of the earth inevitably produce race mixture, and have produced it since before history began. No one has been able to show that this is necessarily bad. They're making an argument from ignorance here, arguing that, nobody has ever proved it, so therefore it isn't necessarily bad. I would say it's very simple. If it's so inevitable, then why do they have to take the trouble to argue in favor of race mixing, if it's going to happen anyway? And why do they argue against separation? Another paragraph, and a little further on, but along the same lines, But as far as we know, there are no immutable laws of nature that make racial intermixture harmful. And this is a good point here. Harmful for who? Harmful from whose point of view? You know, tigers can breed with lions, as I mentioned in the last installment. And you get from that either Tigons or Ligers. And if they only did that, if they only mixed with each other, well, then tigers and lions would both eventually disappear. And the only thing left would be this strange mixture of the two. And you could say, oh, well, you know, no immutable laws of nature make extinction like that harmful. And, well, they didn't really go extinct anyway. They mixed and became one. Well, you know what makes it harmful is group identity, group self-awareness, group morality, the group's judgment of what's good and bad. That's what makes words like harmful have meaning. There was a book written by Arthur Gobineau about the middle of the 19th century titled The Inequality of Human Races. And his thesis in that book was that in each society throughout recorded history, the society was really an expression of a racial core and race in the fine grained sense of nation, in the old classic sense of nation, and that the undoing of each of those societies was race mixing. That's what caused degeneracy and their ultimate collapse. It was sort of a Peter principle of race that he outlined. He didn't call it that, but you know, this idea that the success of a given group of people would produce first expansion and conquest of their neighbors, and then eventually they would dilute themselves out of existence by mixing with the people that they had conquered. The pamphlet goes on in a section titled Racial Superiorities and Inferiorities. And they make the point about to prove superiority, scientists say you have to test abilities. And the section continues, science therefore treats human racial differences as facts to be studied and mapped. It treats racial superiorities as a separate field of investigation. It looks for evidence. When a Nazi says, quote, I am a blue-eyed Aryan and you are a non-Aryan, unquote, he means, quote, I am superior and you are inferior, unquote. The scientist says, quote, of course, you are fair-haired, long-headed, and tall, a tall Northern European. The anthropological term is Nordics, not Aryans. And I am a dark-haired, round-headed, less tall Southern European. But on what evidence do you base your claim to be superior? That is quite different, unquote. Race prejudice turns on this point of inferiority and superiority. The man with race prejudice says of a man of another race, quote, no matter who he is, I don't have to compare myself with him. I'm superior anyway. I was born that way, unquote. Yeah, this issue of superiority, inferiority is really a central issue in race, the argument of race versus anti-race, anti-racism. And it's really anti-racism, I think, that turns on this, that really makes a big show of this inferiority versus superiority. I mean, what they're trying to do is tap into a psychological, it's like a psychological jujitsu move, tapping into people's insecurity and the fear of being deemed inferior. And what they do is they're taking here what a racist might say, which is simply that we're born different. And that's an explicit statement that it doesn't really, superiority, inferiority isn't really the issue. It's the difference that's the issue for a quote unquote racist. He's just saying we're different and that's enough, really. You don't have to get into superiority versus inferiority. I've talked about it though before, that from a person's point of view with a healthy identity as part of a group, of course your group is superior to other groups. Otherwise, you wouldn't be a member of it. You wouldn't want to be a member of it. And that's exactly what we see when we're told that we should feel guilty about these things rather than prideful. It has a predictable effect. I mean, guilt produces a tearing down of identity, and pride produces a building up of identity. And the consequences of that tearing down and building up are perfectly predictable. And this is an aspect of human psychology. Perhaps I'll dig into that in a future installment. It turns out the very next section is the section that focuses on IQ. And this is the thing that made this pamphlet so controversial that Wikipedia mentioned. And I was under the assumption, before I got to this point, that the PDF that was available on archive.org was a complete PDF. But it turns out it's missing pages 16 and 17. It's the only part of the document that's missing. And it's missing in both the scanned version and that's, you know, images in the PDF, and also in the OCR text version. And so I went on a long search on the internet to see if I could find another free version that I could download, and I couldn't. I found several links that led me to versions I could pay for, anywhere from $20, the one I mentioned a few installments ago, to $30, to one from a rare bookseller that wants $120 for a version of the pamphlet. I have no idea. There's no explanation why those pages are missing, but I'm a little chagrined by that. So I'll quote the little bit that is left on the following page, the tail end of the argument about IQ. They write, "The white race did badly where economic conditions were bad and schooling was not provided, and Negroes living under better conditions surpassed them. The difference did not arise because people were from the North or the South or because they were white or black, but because of differences in income, education, cultural advantages, and other opportunities." Now, the Wellfish Wiki page on this section and on this controversy describes it this way. "The most controversial statement in the whole pamphlet was the mention of a set of IQ tests administered to the American Expeditionary Force, the AEF, in World War I, in which Southern whites scored below Northern Negroes. Wellfish, or at least that's what Wellfish and Benedict claimed. They argued that, quote, the difference arose because of differences of income, education, cultural advantages, and other opportunities, since Southern schools spent only a fraction of the amount spent on education in the North. This was the statement that led to a general outcry in the military. The bulk of the pamphlet was dedicated to explaining that perceived differences in group mental abilities vary in accordance with social and cultural factors, not biological ones." I couldn't find the IQ study that's referred to here by searching for AEF or American Expeditionary Force and IQ and World War I and a variety of searches that I tried to find it. So if anyone knows of a link to that study, I'd like to see it. I'd also like to see, of course, these missing pages from the pamphlet. Maybe someday I will find a complete pamphlet. But I think we know enough here about the methods that they use to argue. That's the purpose of this review here, is to examine in detail and to refute and point out the lies, how they're lying and misleading. And when it comes to racial differences in IQ, you might read a more recent exposition of the science and the understanding of it in a book titled The Bell Curve. And the idea of that book, the thesis there, is that there are these bell-shaped curves of IQ, even amongst whites or any group that you might study, and that these curves do overlap with each other. The black bell curve overlaps with the white American bell curve. But the fallacy here, and this, again, a deliberate attempt to induce confusion about this issue, is to take the overlap and treat it as if it's equality, when the reality is that it's just overlap. The centers of gravity of the two bell curves are different. They're not lined up. So there is a difference in IQ that's been measured and has been detected consistently over time. And all that Wellfish and Benedict seem to be arguing is that if you spend enough money educating blacks, preparing them for an IQ test, training them, that you can make the high end of the black bell curve outperform the low end of the white bell curve. I mean, it's really kind of a silly argument, but it was a silly enough argument that it got the pamphlet ultimately discontinued by the Army for being subversive, as we covered, I think, two installments ago. But this is the essence, this kind of an argument, confusing things like this, is the essence of a Jewish anti-racist fraud, really. It's come to be known as the Lewontin fallacy. In most cases, real scientists try to identify and control for various independent variables, and they try to understand the influence of these independent variables in isolation from each other to determine how much is due to each different influence. But instead, in cases like this, we see the use of a kind of it's also confusing argument, where the attempt is to do exactly the opposite, to throw a whole bunch of things together and say, oh, well, it's just so confusing, and you know, you should be confused by this. It's an attempt to obfuscate rather than to clarify. The next section is titled Character Not Inborn. The second superiority which man claims when he says, I was born a member of a superior race, is that his race has better character. The Nazis boasted of their racial soul, but when they wanted to make a whole new generation into Nazis, they didn't trust to racial soul. They made certain kinds of teaching compulsory in the schools. They broke up homes where the parents were anti-Nazi. They required boys to join certain Nazi youth organizations. By these means, they got the kind of national character they wanted, but it was a planned and deliberately trained character, not an inborn racial soul. Well, I think that that's true, that they did put a big emphasis on training the youth properly. And I think that the anti-racists are pretty obviously hypocritical about that, in that they seem to be saying that this is somehow proves that race doesn't exist, and implying that they wouldn't do such a thing, when they just do the exact opposite. They indoctrinate people that race doesn't exist and it doesn't matter, and use dishonest arguments about it to accomplish their goals. The section continues, race prejudice is, after all, a determination to keep a people down, and it misuses the label inferior to justify unfairness and injustice. Race prejudice makes people ruthless. It invites violence. It is the opposite of good character, as it is defined in the Christian religion, or in the Confucian religion, or in the Buddhist religion, or the Hindu religion, for that matter. Well, this idea of keeping a people down, is it keeping a people down to say that they're not part of your group and kick them out of your country? Is that keeping a people down? I think keeping a people down would be lying to them about true biological differences in race and telling them that they have to share their country with other alien peoples, and they have to do this, and never explaining why they have to do this. Why is this an imperative? But using instead propaganda and lies and deceit to convince people to do it. And when that fails, just using force. And that's what the anti-racists do. In the next section, civilization not caused by race. These are just bald assertions that they're making here, that character is not inborn and civilization is not caused by race. This section says, history proves that progress in civilization is not the monopoly of one race or subrace. When our white forebears in Europe were rude Stone Age primitives, the civilizations of the Babylonians and the Egyptians had already flourished and had been eclipsed. There were great Negro states in Africa when Europe was a sparsely settled forest. Negroes made iron tools and wove fine cloth for their clothing when fair-skinned Europeans wore skins and knew nothing of iron. When Europe was just emerging from the Middle Ages, Marco Polo visited China and found there a great civilization, the like of which he had never imagined. Europe was like a frontier country in those days compared with China. What they're doing in this section is just trying to insult whites, just set us down a peg, really, by saying, oh, you people, you think you're so great, but you're not so great. You used to wear skins and be primitive. And I would say to that, so what? We're still different from these other people that you're citing. The fact that at one point we wore skins and were primitive doesn't change that fact. The United States, they continue, is the greatest crossroads of all the world in all of history. People have come here from every race and nation, and almost every race in the world is represented among our citizens. They have brought with them their own ways of cooking food, so that our American diet is indebted to a dozen peoples. Our turkey, corn, and cranberries come from the Indians. Our salads, we borrowed from the French and Italians. Increasingly in recent years, we have enriched our tables with soups from Russia, vegetables from Italy, appetizers from the Scandinavian countries, seafoods from the Mediterranean lands, chili and tortillas from Mexico, and so on, almost endlessly. I have trouble believing that they included this as an argument, but then again, it just shows how classic this anti-racist argument is. The idea is that all of these foods somehow require that we have all of these alien peoples among us. It doesn't, obviously. As you know, if you've ever walked into a Mexican restaurant and seen non-Mexicans cooking the food, or walked into a Chinese restaurant and seen Mexicans cooking the food, it's not necessary to have the people who originated any particular type of food mix with you and invite them into your home to live in your country and share your country with them in order to have and enjoy their food. It's ridiculous. Now, getting closer to the conclusion to this pamphlet, we get to a section titled The Future of Race Prejudice. Nevertheless, there is race prejudice in America and in the world. Race prejudice isn't an old universal quote-unquote instinct. It is hardly 100 years old. Before that, people persecuted Jews because of their religion, not their blood. They enslaved Negroes because they were pagans, not for being black. Looking back now, moderns are horrified at all the blood that was shed for centuries in religious conflicts. It is not our custom anymore to torture and kill a man because he has a different religion. The 21st century may well look back on our generation and be just as horrified. If that century builds its way of life on the Atlantic Charter for the whole world, our era will seem a nightmare from which they have awakened. They will think we were crazy. Quote, why should race prejudice have swept the Western world, unquote, they will say. Quote, where no nation was anything but a mixture of all kinds of racial groups. Why did nations just at that moment begin talking about the racial purity of their blood? Why did they talk of their wars as racial wars? Why did they make people suffer? Not because they were criminals or double-crossers, but because they were Jews or Negroes or non-Nordics, unquote. We who are living in these troubled times can tell them why. Today, weak nations are afraid of the strong nations. The poor are afraid of the rich. The rich are afraid that they will lose their riches. People are afraid of one another's political or economic power. They are afraid of revenge for past injuries. They are afraid of social rejection. Conflict grows fat on fear. And the slogans against inferior races lead us to pick on them as scapegoats. We pin on them the reason for all our fears. The next section is titled Race Prejudice Not Inevitable. It goes right into this. Freedom from fear is the way to cure race prejudice. I have a lot to say about this. Hello from the 21st century. I can tell you what it's like from our point of view, okay? Just like this pamphlet is trying to tell us from 70 years ago what their nightmare was, I can tell them from 70 years later how worse the nightmare has got, however bad they thought they had it. And it's because the people who wrote this pamphlet got their way. They got more than what they were arguing for in this pamphlet. There are still weak and strong countries today, weak and strong people. They're still rich and poor. The main difference is that today the anti-racists are in charge, and their scapegoats are the racists. That's just to sum that up. Let me go back and review this from the beginning here, this idea that prejudice isn't an old universal instinct. is false. It was perhaps only 100 years old that race had been studied as a science by scientists. Maybe even that the word race had only been used for a couple of hundred years. But the instincts, the nature, the human nature that it was identifying was actually much older, was ancient, is ancient. It still exists, just because they deny it today, and that's the official line of the people who rule, doesn't mean that it doesn't exist or has stopped existing. The blood is still shed, as it was in previous conflicts, and we just shed it for different reasons now. It's still for race, too, but there are other excuses for sending the military, the U.S. military, for instance, off to war for the empire. And mainly, I'll point out, for the benefit of the Jews, the wealthy Jews. And that's something else we know 70 years on, that today it's very clear that the Jews are exceedingly rich. They're among the richest groups on earth and the most powerful. They're not victims. This business about acting like they're poor victims is it's really ridiculous. It's more ridiculous now than it ever was in the past. The fears that we're supposedly freed by or freed from, we haven't been freed from. And the fear of revenge for past injuries, well, I think white people have have that fear, because our countries now we're losing control politically, and the people who are taking control want revenge for past injuries. We have to be afraid of social rejection by our friends and family who just think that racism is stupid, crazy, and evil. They've been convinced by this propaganda put out by the anti-racists. And as I said, we're the scapegoats. The Atlantic Charter was a pivotal policy statement, first issued in August of 1941, early on in World War II, and it defined the Allied goals for the post-war world. It was drafted by Britain and the United States initially, but it was later agreed upon by all the Allies. It stated the ideals of the war, the goals, no territorial aggrandizement, no territorial changes made against the wishes of the people, restoration of self-government to those deprived of it, free access to raw materials, reduction of trade restrictions, global cooperation to better secure economic and social conditions for all, freedom from fear and want. It's, you know, basically utopian and unrealistic and undelivered. Self-determination is not something that this anti-racist elite that rules us really recognizes or respects.